As America begins the celebration of its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum thought it would be appropriate to create our own recognition of this important milestone. Welcome to Vashon 250, a look back at what was happening in America 250 years ago and comparing it to what has happened over the past 250 years of American history, what is happening in our current political life, and how these ideals and events have been reflected in the history of our own Vashon Island. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Hallman.
Thanks, John. Our approach to Vashon 250 during this 250th year of the United States of America as an independent nation uses the Declaration of Independence as an aspirational mission statement, the Constitution as a working user's manual, and the events of the American Revolution as a guide to help us understand who we are as a nation, how we came to be who we are, and how Vashon Island fits into this larger narrative structure.
This week, we are exploring the impacts of the March 24, 1765 Quartering Act. The Quartering Acts were several acts of the Parliament of Great Britain, which required local authorities in the 13 colonies of British North America to provide British Army personnel in the colonies with housing and food. Each of the Quartering Acts was an amendment to the Mutiny Act and required annual renewal by the Parliament. They were originally intended as a response to issues which arose during the French and Indian War and soon became a source of tensions between the inhabitants of the colonies and the government of London. These tensions would later lead toward the American War of Independence. These acts were the reason for the Third Amendment to the United States Constitution.
The Quartering Act provided that colonial authorities would arrange for British troops to be housed in local barracks and public houses under the Mutiny Act of 1765. But if the soldiers outnumbered the housing available, would quarter them in, quote, inns, livery stables, ale houses, victualling houses, and the houses of sellers of wine, and the houses of persons selling rum, brandy, strong water, cider, or methylated gin. I just love that. Strong water in the 1700s is actually any alcoholic drink, what we would call a cocktail today. And methylated gin was essentially mead or honey wine. So interesting sort of use.
High quality liquor.
Exactly, very high. And then it went on, and if the numbers required in, quote, uninhabited houses, outhouses, barns, or other buildings, colonial authorities would be required to pay the cost of housing and feeding those soldiers. This became the basis of grievance 13 in part of the 27 grievances in the United States Declaration of Independence that listed the colonials' grievances against the king and explicitly noted, quote, he has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation for quartering large bodies of troops among us.
So all of this disharmony, Bruce, led to the Third Amendment of the Constitution, which placed restrictions on quartering soldiers in private homes without the owner's consent, as they would say, forbidding the practice in peacetime. Correct?
Yes, and the Third Amendment actually reads, "No soldier shall, in times of peace, be quartered in any house, without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law." In other words, they can't come in and just put a soldier in your house without your permission. And if it's during time of war, if they pass legislation, there has to be compensation and other sort of legal precedents before any troops can be stationed or housed in your private home or private property.
So has to date, so where are we, 2026, it's never been the primary basis of a Supreme Court decision, has it?
No, it hasn't. And it's only been the basis of a couple court cases that never made it past the appeals court, because it's very clear what it means.
So, Bruce, haven't American troops and forts always been a part of the American frontier as the settlements moved west? At least in the movies, it is.
Oh yeah, yeah, and I mean, it's always instructive to remind ourselves how America moved westward and settled westward. We always had troops and forts along the frontier, and remember, America doesn't have one frontier; it's a moving frontier. I mean, the first frontier and part of the Revolutionary War is what's called the Trans-Appalachian West. So that area just west of the Appalachian Mountains, east of the Mississippi River, which after the Revolutionary War became part of the United States, but was claimed by various states and was not settled. And of course, there was reluctance to allow settlers to go in. And part of the French and Indian War and part of the British sort of restrictions on the colonists was to keep them from moving across the Appalachian Mountains. To sort of keep the native tribes, the Indians, if you will, of the Trans-Appalachian West pacified. Well, that, of course, didn't work very well.
Not at all.
And then once the United States gets the Louisiana Purchase, we get this huge swath of land from the Mississippi River westward. And then once the war with Mexico, Mexican-American War, we get this huge swath of land from Texas to California, and basically it's sort of a golden sea kind of situation in the United States. And as Americans move west, they send troops, they build forts, but the American experience is very different than the Canadian experience. What the Americans did is we would send troops and build forts, but we would let settlers go out, and settlers would largely begin to build communities. And because there was not sort of law and order, what you got in the American West was the emergence of vigilantism. And so settlers took care of their own problems. Settlers created their own laws. And then only later, as they became territories and then states, did they begin to build legal structures. Canada did it very differently. Canada would not allow settlers in until after the Mounties had moved west. And the Mounties sort of established sort of law and order in an area, and then they would let settlers in. And so what you get is a Canadian-American very different attitudes about firearms, about the role of police, and about the role of westward movement. And so in the United States, it becomes this almost free-for-all. You know, everybody can carry
the Wild West, as it were.
As was the Wild West, very definitely. But underneath it all is the sense that there are frontier forts built all along the frontier. They're armed, are sort of manned by military forces, and those military forces become the initial sort of governmental law enforcers in the area until they become territories, until they become states, and they begin to structure their own sort of police forces, their own military forces. And so what you get is this truly Wild West, and that's where that sort of whole myth of the cowboy in the American West comes from. That sort of free range, sort of go where you want, settle where you want. Whereas in Canada, a very different attitude. And I think it's instructive because we're on the same piece of land, but very different ways of approaching it.
So did Canada have something analogous to the Homestead Act?
They did. It was very different. The Homestead Act was just probably fueled the American expansion westward more than anything else, because originally it was a part of the Northwest Ordinance, which was the old North. We think of the Northwest as the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. Well, the Northwest Ordinance was when the Northwest of the United States was what is today Michigan and Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, that sort of area. That was the old Northwest. And the Northwest Ordinance from the 1890s essentially set up a mechanism for territories to become states. And what that mechanism sort of demanded is that there be a certain amount of population, there be a certain amount of sort of settlement, there be a certain amount of sort of control of lawlessness, if you will. And then given those conditions, a territory could apply to become a state. It also set up the surveying of the West. And so you had these prime meridians, and everything was divided into townships and sort of squares and square miles sort of areas. And that allowed you to actually determine where your property is. And so that Northwest Ordinance sort of controls the movement westward. And the Homestead Act, which was initially the idea behind the Northwest Ordinance, Homestead Act doesn't actually come into effect until the 1860s. And before it, it's what's called the Oregon Land Donation Act, which was the basis for the Homestead Act. And that was for the Oregon Territory. And it's the idea that you as an individual could claim up to 160 acres. Mm-hmm. If you're a couple, you could get 320 acres, which is a square mile. So you could get a square mile of land basically for paying a small fee. I think it was around $22, $24 registration fee. And then within 5 years, you had to improve the property, which means you go in, you cut down trees, you build a house, you know, whatever. If you improve the property, then it's yours. Well, a square mile of land for $20 and
it's
a couple
steal,
of years'
even
work,
then.
It was a deal. Even then, it was a deal. And that, of course, fueled much of the westward expansion. And, of course, there were abuses. Railroad companies would come in and have employees claim square mile after square mile after square mile that then they would give to their employer. So railroads got huge swatches of land. And then the federal government actually provided land for the railroads as an incentive to build railroad lines. And so there's lots of sort of corruption possibilities going on with the westward movement. But when you step back, the key thing is that it offered an ability to get land relatively inexpensively. And it offered land and the people who settled the land a sort of roadmap to becoming a territory and becoming a state. And behind it all was the presence of forts and soldiers to help preserve the peace. And what that really meant was control the native population.
So let's get back to the whole question of military engagement and taking of property, et cetera, and take that forward from the Wild West and look at today's world. We have the National Guard being sent to communities. We've got the ICE agents doing their thing. I think that's caused great consternation among most of us. And certainly we could argue that point, but the reality is you have to scratch your head and go, how does this fit with the Constitution and the law? So what do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, Americans, and it goes back to the Quartering Act, it goes back to the American Revolution. Americans and colonists at the time were always suspicious about having military troops in their areas. You know, particularly during colonial times, because the troops didn't represent the colonies. They represented the British government in London. And so there's a built-in sort of a prejudice in the United States against having military forces, you know, billeted or you know, roaming freely in populated areas. You know, and that sort of translates into what ultimately becomes the Posse Comitatus Act, which forbids the federal government from having federal troops engaged in any kind of activity of law enforcement or enforcing federal law in, you know, populated areas, in cities, and in states, without the permission of the states. And that's where we see ourselves today, particularly with the situations going on in American cities, particularly democratically controlled American cities, where the federal government is beginning to deploy National Guard troops. And of course, that's being fought through the courts, whether or not the president has the right to call up state National Guard troops without the permission of the state governor, unless the troops are federalized, which hasn't happened at this point, or to bring in federal troops, you know, regular military forces, which break the Posse Comitatus Act. And of course, that's being fought through the courts right now, and that traces right back to the Quartering Act and to the Revolutionary times, when colonists did not want British soldiers roaming the streets, living in their houses, and sort of disrupting, you know, daily life.
So as we've said multiple times now, in some ways history repeats itself. This is, in this modern age, though, this is a pretty significant question mark about what goes forward.
Yeah, and I think it's best to sort of get that word repeat out of your vocabulary, because okay, history doesn't repeat itself. What it does, it echoes itself. It rhymes with itself, because every event is contextual. There's a certain context to each event, and that context changes, but the nature of what that context is and the nature of what the conflict behind what's happening is what we see continuing, and it continues from the revolution to today. But what we see with National Guard troops being sent into the cities is not a repeat of what we saw with colonial troops being sent from England into the colonies, but it's a very similar situation, but it's different because the context is different. And that's where I think it's important to remember history doesn't repeat itself, but the issues that we deal with are the same issues that we dealt with 250 years ago, 200 years ago, 150 years ago, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and today. You know, it's just part of what it is.
And they are the reason we have the laws and traditions that we have.
Exactly. Exactly.
So let's take this forward to Vashon Island. We have cases here of eminent domain. And I'm thinking of the early 50s when our missile battery was built. Talk a little bit about that, because that involved bringing military people to our community. We didn't take over private homes, but we did use eminent domain to buy that property and then build barracks.
Exactly. Yeah. And it goes back even further than that. It goes back to the very first settlement of Washington Territory. When the southwest corner of Vashon Island, Point Dalco, what is now largely Pole Road, so from Tahlequah west to Covo's Passage, that part of Vashon Island was a military reserve. And the concept was the military took over that land when Vashon was very first surveyed. So in the 1850s, that was set aside as a military reservation or military reserve. And it was to be combined with a similar piece of land at Point Defiance, which is now largely Point Defiance Park, and an area on the heights above Gig Harbor. And the idea was to build three forts to protect Puget Sound. Now remember, at this time, Puget Sound was from the Tacoma Narrows south. Everything from the Tacoma Narrows north was called Admiralty Inlet. Well, ultimately, it sort of gets all conflated and all called Puget Sound. But in the 1850s, essentially, you know, Puget Sound, and as the American government surveyed this area, Puget Sound was south of the Tacoma Narrows. And so they were going to protect Olympia, basically, the state capital, by building forts on Vashon, Point Defiance in Tacoma, and Gig Harbor. Well, they had done a similar thing up at Point Wilson, at Port Townsend, and on Maristone Island, and on Whidbey Island. And what they figured, once they got those built and had the batteries installed, they thought nobody would ever get through those, so they never built the forts down here. But that land remained military reserve land until 1921. What's interesting for Vashon, and the question you asked, John, is that land sat empty, you know, from the 1850s basically until 1921, except for the squatters came in and took over and built their houses and took over the land. And actually in 1921, it took an act of Congress to decommission that land. They broke it into 10-acre plots, and they sold those plots at a very small sum to the squatters who had settled on it. And so from the very beginning, Vashon the First, when it's first surveyed, Vashon has a military presence. We don't see military troops on Vashon Island until World War II. And sort of with the beginning of World War II, you know, the sort of removal of the Japanese, you have federal troops coming onto the island, rounding up the giant Japanese population and taking them off on a special ferry and sending them to the American concentration camps. And then as a result of that, you have troops actually stationed on Vashon, small contingent of troops. So, at Center School, so basically at the corner of Vashon Highway and 220th, you had a military presence there. It was small, but you still had soldiers for the very first time on Vashon Island. And then as World War II ends, those troops leave the islands without a military presence until the Cold War starts. And then with the beginning of the Cold War in the late 1940s, in the early 1950s, the military begins to become what becomes known as the Seattle Defense Ring. They're worried about aerial attack, particularly from Russian bombers and nuclear weapons. And so what they do is they begin to build anti-aircraft bases all around the Seattle area. And on Vashon, they built what's called Charlie Battery, just south of Vashon Town to the east side of Vashon Highway, where the Eagles are. The Eagles Lodge on Vashon is actually the mess hall for Charlie Battery. And from 1951 until about 1954, 55, there was a set of anti-aircraft guns, you know, sort of military bases, a military base, barracks, you know, a mess hall, you know, officers' quarters, all that stuff in that area that is now the Eagles Lodge. And when that base was decommissioned in 1953-54, the Eagles actually bought the building and turned it into their lodge. The reason Charlie Battery was decommissioned was because they changed from anti-aircraft guns to anti-aircraft missiles, which were the Nike missiles, and became the basis for the Nike base at Sunrise Ridge, which was the command center, and the launch site, which is at Paradise Ridge Horse Park. And in 1954-55, the government began to buy that property from landowners who were not happy about selling it, particularly on Sunrise Ridge, because you have great views of Mount Rainier from up on top.
Perfect place to build your retirement home.
Exactly, and a perfect place for an aircraft base. But and so what you get in the 1950s, late 1950s, early 1960s, is the construction of a Nike base here on Vashon Island.
And in today's, I guess with many of our newcomers to the island in the last few years, the idea of a missile base on the island seems abhorrent, but it existed, and it was here until the mid-70s.
It did, yeah. It
and was there actually, were, what, 300 people? 300 troops?
Yeah, probably 200, 250 personnel at the Nike
So there was
base.
A pretty active, for the size of the island, a pretty active
It was
military community here.
Yeah, it was, and of course they built base housing, the west side of Vashon Highway. That little sort of housing development there was built for Nike base. The Nike base itself, Sunrise Ridge, was the command center. They had all the sort of fire control mechanisms here. They had the radars, all of that kind of stuff. They had barracks, which barracks essentially are now the health center. They had the mess hall, which is essentially now Vashon Cooperative Preschool, and then the area down, the lower buildings were essentially headquarters buildings. They had a PX. It was a full-blown military base. And then over at Paradise Ridge was a launch site, and so they actually had silos for the Nike missiles. And these weren't silos in the sense that they were big round tubes down in the ground. The Nike missiles were on levered sort of launch platforms, so they had sort of covered pits, if you will. The covers would roll back off, the missiles would sort of raise up and then fire. And of course, both with Charlie Battery and with the Nike base, nothing was ever fired from Vashon Island. It would probably have destroyed half the glass on Vashon Island if they'd done that. They do all their live exercises over at the Yakima firing range. But they were ready to go. And so, particularly for the Nike base from 1954-55 up to 1974, it was an active missile base on Vashon Island. One of the fascinating things to me about it is that in the late 60s, they made a change from the Nike Ajax missile to the Nike Hercules missile. Well, what's that all about? Well, Nike Ajax was a single stage, single rocket designed to take out a single airplane. The Hercules was actually three Nike Ajax sort of bundled together that carried a nuclear warhead that would take out a whole fleet of Soviet bombers. And so what many people don't realize is we essentially had nuclear weapons here on Vashon Island for the last 4 or 5 years before the base closed. And when they closed the base, what I found fascinating, I found a newspaper report. When the base closed, there was one newspaper report about a whole bunch of trucks coming onto the island after the ferry stopped running, loaded up everything from the base, and left before dawn of the next day. And that's when I think they probably moved the nuclear weapons off of Vashon Island. We don't know for certain. Those records are still closed. But I think it's a fascinating sense that Vashon was part of this defense ring. There were 13 Nike bases around Seattle. Vashon was one of them. When they changed from the Nike Ajax to the Nike Hercules, they closed 10 of those 13 bases. They kept three of them, and one of those three was Vashon Island because they had nuclear warheads.
And with that, that'll make you go, that's an interesting little bit. And today, all those properties are owned either by the Parks Department or the basis for the health center, the original basis for the health center, nonprofit. So all this property sits here that was once owned privately and converted for military use. So that wraps up our whole question of the quartering acts and where history continues to serve us now and in the future. Bruce and I invite you to join us each week for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island heritage. And our programs are available on the Voice of Vashon website at voiceofvashon.org. Go to the site and click on your choice of saved programs. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic, please drop us a note to Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. That's Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a presentation of Voice of Vashon, Your Island Connection. The show is produced by Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services. NACM serves business, credit, and finance departments across the Fruited Plain. We appreciate their support. And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.